Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend's edition. Another very busy and chaotic week. So much uncertainty in these markets. And quite frankly, I find it hard to really parse through all the news, make sense of it. The more I read, it feels like the less I know. Throughout the week, we had a lot of commentators come on and a lot of company updates too, trying to keep everybody up to speed on what's going on company specific. But the fact of the matter is, I think it is also kind of a big picture look we need to take at simply managing portfolios and positioning ourselves in this time of so much uncertainty. We are going to spend this weekend's show mostly on kind of jumping around a number of different markets, focusing mostly on the charts rather than the news, because in this time we actually had Joel Conan earlier on this week say that when we are in times of this much uncertainty and we don't know what to believe in terms of the news, we really just need to focus on the charts and price action. To kick off this show, we are chatting with Rick Bensinger, president of Bensinger Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, check out the In the Know Trader website. Rick has two products there, a weekly report called The Tactical Trader and a daily report called The Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, from a big picture standpoint, as I said, I think in my adult life, I've never seen so much uncertainty for markets and for war, unfortunately. And let's just talk about what you do with your portfolio in times of uncertainty. Rick, what are you doing?
Well, look, Corey, we lined up earlier this year. We've talked about this, and you know, you and I and Chad talk every month. So you guys know that earlier this year, we had lightning exposure because of the record-setting amount of upside exhaustion signals from DeMarc models that appeared in the S&P. 14 actual signals, all of which remained active. The market didn't move up enough to stop them out. So 14 on the daily chart, I think it was 3 or 4 on the weekly chart. It was an unprecedented collection of signals that we've never seen before. And therefore, for months, we were just kind of lightning exposure looking for a decline. And the low in the S&P, what was it, probably 2 weeks ago or so, was intraday low was 629 and change. Our downside, or one of the important downside targets, was 632. So we bought a little bit back, but the up move since has been, you know, a ferocious up move, similar to, if you think about a year ago, you know, yesterday was the anniversary of the April 9th low from 2025. So almost, you know, close to, I guess, 51 weeks later, we kind of bottomed and the quick move up. But what a lot of investors don't know out in the public, and that, you know, we have a better handle on when you're dealing with institutions and talking to institutions and look at it with a different eye, is just how much, let's call it, shorting had been done by hedge funds in the last several months, to the tune of, they were most negatively positioned than they had been since COVID, which is why if you had any good news, you were going to see the market react like it did. So a lot of this up move is short covering from hedge funds and to some degree speculators, but you know, the speculators generally aren't the ones pushing the market as much as hedge funds and the guys with collectively a boatload of money can do. So this a lot of this reaction up is simply short covering and prior, you know, longs using some of the strength to lighten up on. Today's high, you know, today's Friday, today's high happens to be exactly at the downtrend line from the mid-February high, which is not the all-time high, but there is no real good down, because since the all-time high, the mid-February high was so close to it, it's the mid-February high that you're really kind of going to draw your downtrend on. And that already had 2 points to it. So today makes it 3 points. We're pulling back from there. And there's a big gap on the chart now for, in spider terms, from 660 to about 671.5, which we could easily back and fill into in the next week or so. But look, this type move shows you the degree to which markets can move based on positioning, and you've got to have a sense of positioning to understand this. It's interesting. There was a technician who's frequently on the business channels who at the lows was saying, I don't think it's the lows because there's the polls, the commonly used polls don't show enough bears yet. And yet the poll that I rely on and comment on and use as a important gauge of how institutions are positioned showed only 15% bulls going into or at the low 2 weeks ago. So, you know, you can't get a heck of a lot less than 15% bulls. The all-time low ever for S&Ps was 3% bulls, and that was on going into March 10th, 2009, the lowest low of the Great Financial Crisis, and when we got long, much to do with that 3% bullish rate, bullish number, as well as the fact that the market had sold down to exactly, it was 666, I remember, in spiders that I had put in print months earlier as where the bottom would likely be. So it's also getting your hands on the right information and not necessarily the common stuff that you see on TV and hear people talking about. And even, you know, there's people who manage money who are, quote, professionals and in theory on the institutional side, but many of them are not in tuned to, I don't know how to say it, the way a Goldman Sachs or a Morgan Stanley or some of the better tier one sell side firms look at the market and have information. Many PMs are just kind of traditional in their ways of thinking about the market, and they don't put a lot of credence on some of the type data that I think is instrumental in understanding markets, including investor positioning, the, let's call it the behavioral finance side of the business. And as you and your listeners know, you know, this is kind of a specialty of mine, something that's helped me differentiate myself for many years on the street compared to many other strategists, is understanding behavioral finance and how it specifically relates to the markets and investors' timing of when they make the decisions that they do. And often, if you understand the role of each of the players on Wall Street, and there's kind of three main players that you can bucket people into. You have the buy side, which are portfolio managers and, you know, hedge fund type people. You have the sell side, who's putting out research. And then you have traders. And those are the three key sectors or buckets that you can put people into. I've had roles over my 45-year career on the street in all three of those buckets. Most people don't have more than one. Some have two. Very few have three. And it's my understanding, having spent years in each one of those, that helps me often be able to understand why the market moves, not just when it does, but kind of from where it does. And that additional understanding of people making decisions where they do because of the pressures of their job and a boss over them saying, you know, hey, you're down money, you're down more money, 2 weeks later, you're down more money, you better either change, you know, if you're a sell side research guy, you got people long a stock at 100 that's trading 40, you know, you're going to have to change your call, you're going to have to do something. And it's often when they make those decisions and change their calls that you can almost always anticipate a turn, because they've reached their maximum pain threshold and finally they change and downgrade a stock just as it's bottoming. It's a combination of so many different things that we look at in order to help understand why and where the markets turn where they do.
Well, Rick, with that framework, let's dive into what you're seeing here in something like the S&P, because to the point you made technically, there's that gap, which is probably that short covering rally where people did get wrong-sided. And from the behavioral finance side and the positioning side, obviously a lot of people were on the wrong side of the boat if there was only 15% bulls. But that is the time where you see a turn, a tipping point, an inflection point. How are you looking at it now? Are the markets taking off, or do you think that they need to go back and fill that gap, and that maybe they got ahead of themselves because of a short squeeze?
We may still, push a little higher, but I'd be more apt to be a buyer on the pullback at this point now, anywhere from, into the gap, preferably. I don't know, I would probably say something maybe in the name, almost like in the middle of the gap. Let's call it, in spider terms, 665-ish, plus or minus a couple of handles, down to as low as maybe 648-ish. No reason to think we're going back to the lows now. But what you also have to consider in the whole picture is what's going on in Iran. Is the straits, opening or not? Yesterday, I think only five tankers got through, and they were pretty much headed to China. They were Iranian tankers. And, if the price of oil, WTI, goes back up, gets over 110 and stays over 110, we got to, I think it was, what, on the peak, it was 119. You're going to have a whole changed environment again, and you won't make new all-time highs, and then you're going to turn around and put pressure in the market. This is so headline driven, but you got to understand where people are positioned when it's headline driven, because a bullish news event, which we supposedly got several days ago with a ceasefire, saw a huge up move relative to what it probably should have been. But because you had the largest short positioning by hedge funds that you've had in years, you got an overshoot now, a big move. And we may not be done. We're kind of stopping at a natural place to pause. It's a Friday. It's a weekly options expiration. And once I bring that up, I'll tell you that this week will be the first time in the last four that the bulls got it right. They typically have gotten the option expirations right. The bears have been wrong for probably 85% of this year, but the last three ones they were right, being bearish, until this week. The biggest open interest strikes for spider puts are way, way down. They're super out of the money. I think the 630s, which is where the low was of the move, was the largest open interest for expiration today. The second highest one, I'm trying to remember from yesterday when I wrote the piece, was, I don't know, maybe it was lower than that, or still deep, deep out of the money. So you've seen, at least now, the bulls got this one right for expiration for today. But again, over the last month, it's the first time the bulls have had it right. But collectively, over this, since January 1st, the bulls have been right almost every expiration, and the bears have been wrong until pretty much, mid-March. So what do I think now? I think you haven't cleaned out the short base yet. If a headline or something helps bring this back down, I think you'd probably now, should find support in this, mid-660s down to, I don't know, we'll call it as low as mid-6 to upper 640s. I don't think we'd likely go beneath there then, that range now, unless you have a new event that again changes, the Mideast changes what's going on. And so much of it is driven by oil, so you have to watch oil. I don't recommend trading oil at all to the average person. In fact, even professional oil traders these days, I'm telling them, go find something else to trade. Unless you literally have to trade that market, there is no reason to do so. It is just way too dangerous, and you have zero edge. And I never trade a market that I have no edge in. And right now, there's no way you have an edge trading the oil market. By the time you hear the news that just made it move $5 or $10 a barrel, it's too late for you to act. So, right now, midday on Friday, market's making new lows after opening higher. I could see us potentially, selling off into the close. Without a positive headline between now and 4 p.m. Eastern Time in New York today, I think the market probably fades, given how much it's run this week. So it's just, there's investing, there's trading, there's swing trading. For investors, look, my wife is an investor. She doesn't sell. And she sees me, selling and buying, and I'm doing this and doing that, and sometimes I'm cursing, and sometimes I'm loving what I'm doing. And and she's like, honey, if you believe in the company and stuff, you just hold and you deal with these pullbacks. It all depends where you fall on that scale of how Are you totally long term? Are you totally short term? Or what's the combination in between? What I generally tell people is 85% of your money should be invested. If you have that, if not more, if you have the inkling to trade, do not trade with more than 15% of total investable funds. Let professionals manage your money, or just be in, ETFs that track some major indexes that you want exposure to, whether it's in stocks, bonds, commodities. You don't necessarily have to get into the individual stock game, but if you like playing, and I grew up in the commodity pits, I do love playing the game, but limit how much you play relative to what long-term investments you have.
Yeah, I think that's a good little tip for everybody. But fact of the matter is, everybody likes to think that they're smarter than these markets. And Rick, with all this uncertainty, and yes, it's driven by headlines, and no one knows what's coming next. Were you surprised at all that, okay, the markets were a little bit weak before the war started, and then the war escalated? It was ugly. Even earlier this week, the US, in a way, kind of threatened nuclear war. You surprised at all that the S&P was only down 10% in this environment?
No, it was orderly. And part of it is the public's gotten used to buying these dips. They learned it from COVID. Market came off hard, but then it came storming back. In 2022, you had a down year of 20%, and then it came storming back to new all-time highs. Last year, we fell 20% from February to the April low. So it's a quick, painful 20%. And then it turns around, storms back to new all-time highs. So it was a very orderly decline. There was no panic. And, until even the 200-day broke, most people were, dealing with it okay. And then once the 200-day broke, and I don't know, I think it was the third week of March, something like that, then you saw things accelerate to the downside. But it's still been orderly in the scheme of things. And people also, because Trump has, this is round two as being a president. They learn from the first time around some of, what he does, how he says what he does. That phrase taco, Trump always chickens out. People are, you like him or not, and the country is quite divided on that. They kind of understand the man to some degree because they already have experience with him and know that he's, at least in his own mind, a negotiator. And so the first, comments he makes aren't necessarily at all what he truly plans. Remember when he came out with, I think it was 145% tariffs that he was going to put on China? And then ultimately what it was is a fraction of it. So the public is getting used to the way he operates, the way he thinks, and therefore I think that's what attributed to it being a much more orderly decline in the scheme of things, because he is market focused. He's got wealthy friends, and none of them want to see the market getting trashed. So he kind of has that in mind more than many other presidents have had. And he tries to keep the markets calm and occasionally says something that he know will boost the market, giving some relief to pressure. So now when you think about the market was off, in the neighborhoods of what, 60 S&P handles? Spider handle, something like that, 60, what, 60, almost 70, was it 28, 90, 70-ish handles or so in spider terms. So, you're in the neighborhoods of 10%, and it's recouped the bulk of it up until today, where, it's pulling back a little. This is just kind of the norm now for how markets are moving and reaction. You've got this major rounding top that's been in place for 6 months in the S&P with spike bottoms that turn around. But now you might very well have a spike top that, sees this coming and potentially, again, play with that gap in coming days and weeks that was made this week. That's the rhythm of what's happening now. So I think you have to think in terms of sell rallies and buy declines. Get rid of stuff that's not working. Software names are getting just taken out to the woodshed. They are destroying software names, and find some, other things within, if you like tech, find the places within tech that are working and get rid of the stuff that's not. No reason being a hero and trying to hold on to stuff that simply isn't working. And I've sold some stuff today that just didn't work. I bought a major software name yesterday at like the last level I would ever buy it at. And today it opened up, I don't know, $5 lower. I just took my loss and said I was willing to risk it, even gap more than I would have expected, but it's gone. And the market is totally repricing these names. And there's no reason being a hero and sticking with stuff that's just not working.
Yeah, some sound advice, Rick. Well, I want to follow up with something that you said on oil. You said you wouldn't trade it. It's just too volatile. And to the point you made, you know, you could wake up one day and there's news that's happened that's moved it $5 to $10 a barrel one way or the other. What about oil equities? Because as you know, a lot of people that listen to our show are commodities and resource stock focused. And so a lot of people hold oil stocks that are probably listening to this call, Rick. What would you do? Because a lot of us were building models based on oil in the 60s. Now that oil is a lot higher and it probably will at least return to a higher level, even if it comes back down, how would you play oil equities in this environment?
So I think when you think in those terms of, you know, OIH, XOP, or general XLE type component names, the world news has shown you that you want to have some exposure to this group. And, you know, at one point it was under 3% of the S&P, and not that long ago, just, you know, 6 months ago, it was less than 3% of the S&P. Now it's more. I think it's likely going to 65, you know, pre-war or pre any of this type levels again. You had a triple bottom at 55 in WTI, shot up to almost 120. There'll be some equilibrium price in between, but I think what this shows you is that you need to have some energy exposure, but near term, look, it's pulling back and take advantage of the pullback. But if you bought in late today, you know, if you're a recent last week or two, you first got long these names, you're underwater. Most likely you're underwater. And either I hope you didn't buy a lot, or you're going to have to potentially hang on for a while before you see those prices come back, unless something happens in the Middle East and then, you know, all hell breaks loose again, and or we get into boots on the ground or who knows what. I think you want exposure here, but choosing where, you know, is the question. OIH got a bounce on initial support this week, but XLE versus the S&P has a totally different look, and that looks like it's already peaked. I'd say wait for some pullback before you commit, you know, major dollars here. And or if you're the type who's inclined to do, also, you know, you can sell some out of the money calls for what you own, and it's just at least take in some money while you're waiting to see what happens. You know, even like XLE is off, what, 10% or so from last week's high to this week's low. You're talking about 10% or more differential with upside exhaustion signals having shown up last week. So be a little patient and probably wait for a pullback. But you do want exposure. You do want exposure to energy.
Within the energy sector, then, do you see now that it seems like we have a toll in place that apparently is about $1 a barrel for these ships that go through? And quite frankly, I'm sure some countries are saying, how much dependence do we want on oil, especially as the world is fighting with Iran? Do you see other forms of energy, other energy markets getting some more interest?
I honestly, Corey, I don't know. It's, you know, energy, because I look at all markets and do global macro, I don't have that answer for you to know what other pieces, you know, whether it's wind or alternative, what else is getting interest that actually is likely of being successful. I'm sorry, I don't have that.
Well, we have seen a little uptick in uranium prices recently, and so maybe there's some crossover effect there. But yeah, I think it's too early to see a substitution factor at this point for most countries, because those are long-term initiatives they have to put into place. We have seen coal doing well, though, and we have seen several countries in Europe, including Germany, talking about turning back on coal plants. So interesting developments there. But sticking with the commodities, Rick, you know, a lot of people are invested in the precious metals and precious metal stocks in our audience. And some people confused that there wasn't more of a safe haven bid in gold, but obviously gold is reacting more to interest rates and the dollar than it is to a safe haven bid. What's your outlook on the precious metals?
I will tell you that I have substantial, long exposure there. I sold a little near the highs, but not a ton. I added a little bit, especially on the silver side. And actually, I bought some gold just 2 weeks. I think GLD, I paid 205 or so. Is that the right handle or is it 405? So then I got in, I bought some. I'll not pull back to the 200-day moving average that happened just a couple weeks ago. So I added some there. And, or actually, what's funny, it's COMEX Gold that hit its 200-day. GLD didn't, but I bought the GLD when COMEX Gold hit the 200-day. So that was, 405, something like that. It's now 437 today. And it just filled the gap that it had from a couple weeks ago on a big down day. So, it's starting to get a little tired up here. I'd say anywhere from where it is now, let's call it 435 to 465. It should be resistance at this point. But in general, I am a fan of the metals longer term. But think about just like get it. I think investors need to understand that we're talking about gold in round numbers, in the $5,000 neighborhood per ounce of gold. If it fell, and I don't want to see this happen, but if it fell to $3,500 an ounce, it'd be bad if you're long at 5,000, but relative to the price of gold historically, still a crazy upside price. And therefore, as much as, gold kind of makes sense to me now, is trading in a flag pattern off of the all-time highs. And as I mentioned, COMEX Gold just bounced on its 200-day in mid-March. If the flag pattern takes out the top of the flag, essentially the downtrend line from all-time highs, then you'd look at this as just a longer-term continuation pattern, and gold should move higher. And I think over time, given central banks still printing money and so many other issues at hand that made gold even get here in the first place, I think those issues are still there, if not more so. And therefore, over time, I could make the case that gold still goes higher, but in the trading range that it currently has. So in round numbers, COMEX Gold got to front month, let's call it 56 and a quarter, and then just recently got down to, I don't know, what was it, 4,100 or something like that. There's a big envelope of trading range there that this could still stay in for months before it resolves itself in either direction. And I think you need to think of those terms. It's funny, I'm looking at a chart right now, and the day that made the all-time high in gold had a large candle, if you understand like candle patterns, had a large wick to the upside. So the marketplace totally rejected what ultimately was that intraday all-time high. And then in March, when we just hit that 200-day, that was also a large wick to the downside that came all the way back and closed much closer to the higher end of that day's range than the low. That's your big range. So right now, I don't expect the lower side to get taken out. I don't expect the all-time high to get taken out anytime in the near future. Again, if something crazy in the world happens, that can change. But given the way markets trade, I think right now, you've seen the range and will likely see the range for months going forward.
So, Rick, you've been in the commodities game for a long time, and I'm sure you've heard that argument that gold needs to go higher because central banks continue to print money. But we also have seen that it's been cyclical and gold can go through bear markets that can last up to a decade. What's so different about now that has driven gold through this massive bull market? It's gone 5x in about 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's most of it is central bank buying, realizing themselves for the need to own something that actually, in some way, shape, or form, has value and a storage of value over time. Bitcoin has not proven itself to be that over time. And of course, it's sold off 50% of its value in a short amount of time. That's not something gold typically does, or it's, I don't know, I'd have to look way back in time to see, a 50% decline over just a few months in gold. It might have happened 1980 after it peaked, but I don't remember how fast it fell from there. I'm not saying that gold can't get a real pullback, under 4,000. Take out those lows. One of the measurements I use, and I'm trying to see where did this start from. Let's see. So from the 2015, I think it was December of 2015 bottom. And I'm looking at where did I go originally? So from maybe the low in 2000 to the high in 2011, and then take that same proportionate move off of the secular bottom in 2015, we've gotten more than twice that value. But the high, if you understand like Fibonacci projections, 2.618 times that initial move is what they is 54.29, and that is close enough to the 56.29 all-time high. That's $200 as a percentage. It's nothing. You have hit potential target on the upside that for it's possible months, years, many months to years could last as the high. And so where that pullback ends up, if it falls, it could be vicious. You could pull back to under $3,000 an ounce. It's a matter of positioning, who's where, but what keeps me kind of bullish is central bank buying. That's been going on, and who's the net seller now? You have companies that pull gold out of the ground. Who's the net seller? Who's hedging, right? Because normally you'd have natural hedgers, producers who want to hedge their inventory. And certainly at $5,000 an ounce, it's a heck of a lot better hedging it than when it was $1,000 an ounce. So yeah, you have some, perhaps some producers are still hedging. Prior hedging has cost them dearly, but they're not generally in the marketplace to speculate on the same way a corn farmer is not growing corn and trying to hedge it and make money on his hedges. He simply wants to lock in a price that guarantees him a small profit or a larger profit, but not, they're not there to speculate. Who's selling gold now is, I think, what you have to ask yourself if you're in the industry. Other than producers selling forward, production and locking in the price, who's selling? If central banks are still net buyers, who's selling?
Well, it's a great point, Rick. We just talked to a gold producer yesterday that was glad their hedges finally came off in January because they're participating now with more upside, but now they're considering should they hedge again. But you brought up the gold producers. A lot of our audience is invested in those very stocks. So if you look at something like GDX, it's had a nice run over the last 2 years. It had a really epic January, February. It actually made a higher high in February than in January. So unlike gold that top ticked in January, GDX actually kept blasting higher. The average first quarter results were the highest gold price ever in human history from a nominal basis. So the margins are about the fattest they've ever been. But then we saw a big decline March. A lot of stuff got wiped out. I mean, 30%, some individual stocks down 40, 50, 60%. But if you look at GDX, Rick, it went down, tagged the 200-day moving average, and bounced from there. What do you make of something like GDX in this environment?
Similar, I think you have to look at them similarly to gold. At this point, so I had favored GDX over GLD. At this point, I'm not sure I do. They so outperformed. They finally played the catch-up that for years people were looking for but never got. The performance in the last, let's call it 12 months, give or take, has been phenomenally in favor of GDX. I think at this point, I don't have much reason to think GDX makes new highs. And so I'm a little skeptical about how much more upside GDX has in both an outright basis and certainly versus GLD itself. So it's come back. You may make one high. Well, let's see. I just pulled up the chart. So the pullback that we saw actually came right back down into a buy zone that I had told institutional clients. And now it's bounced the last several weeks straight up. It's not at its all-time high. In fact, it's not even clear. So I may reevaluate that. Look, we're still near the top end of a dozen-year range. But if it breaks out, so GDX right now is trading just shy of 23% the price of GLD. If you get above 20, let's see, where's that high? The 2016 high was at 0.244. You get above there, you could easily shoot up to 0.28. So you know what? I'm gonna change what I said, and that is, for now, I don't have a material new reason for GDX to make a new high, but in terms versus GLD, new secular high now probably leads to higher prices and GDX outperformance. I didn't expect myself to say that.
There you go, Rick. Thank you for really just updating us live. That's why I love these interviews and really enjoy chatting with traders like you that are truly just on the ball, not taking any preconceived notions into anything, but just letting the charts tell you where we're going. We are going to have to wrap it up here, but for everyone listening, highly recommend you click the links in the show notes. That's on our website, podcast, or YouTube channel. Or just search in the No Trader. That's where you can keep up to date with what Rick is telling his subscribers and what he is trading. Rick, it's great having you on the show. Thank you very much for taking time with us on this weekend show. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back continuing this more technically focused weekend show, trying to make sense of where these markets are going.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.